Welcome to the Why Isn't It Working? Business and Tech Podcast, talking all things business and tech in the emerging and enterprise space. Here are your hosts, Carl Wood and Michael Hamilton.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. Today we have Sunil Jaha from the Akiko Group. How are you today, Sunil?
I'm good, thanks, Mike. How are you guys doing?
Very well, very well. And also with me, I have Carl Wood as always. How are you, Carl?
Hey, Michael, how are you going? Sunil, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Awesome. Well, Carl, kick off the first question, my friend.
Absolutely. So, Sunil, 30 years in the industry, probably more than 30 years now. I mean, you've been running across everything from the technology sector, sales, marketing, ops, BDM, consulting. So, tell us a little bit about your journey, and just remember, you know, we've only got an hour for this podcast. I know you've got a very rich history, but we might have to ask you to condense it a little bit as well.
No, I can try and keep it as condensed as possible. Look, thanks a lot. 35 plus years. I started in early 80s back in India, and of course, started off as a junior programmer and became a project manager with a large construction company. And then the bug hit me, and I decided to set up my own business. The good thing was that in India at that time, there were not many software development and consulting firms. So I saw that in 6 months' time, the business was starting to grow and there were more people in the business. And that led to me then changing some of the direction of the business from just pure software development, like apps, like, you know, financial accounting and payroll. We decided to go to customers and say, hey, we can do financial accounting and payroll for you, but how about we tie you in with us for inventory and cost control and all the other modules, which today is called ERP. Okay, so that was pre-95 when I started that concept back in India. And I think that's what gave a big boost to the business. And 98, I exited from the business, came to Australia in 99, and of course worked for two of the largest SIs in Australia. One of them was Aspect Computing, which then got sold to CAS Computing and then got sold to Telstra, and then it's dissipated basically. So in 2002, decided to set up my own business in Australia. This time I decided to go against the grain of technology. So I moved one step above technology, which is processes. So I saw a big gap in the marketplace where I saw that companies were moving forward with new technology, but they were still using the same old processes in their businesses, which did not, it was counterproductive for them, basically. So I started building processes in their businesses, you know, workflow processes, workflow automation and everything else, and then bringing the technology in to help them, the people and the processes, basically. That business, again, grew. We set up an office in India in 2005, set up an office in Philippines in 2009, and suddenly from one person, the business was about 150 people across three countries, you know. Got a good exit in 2015. And since then, of course, I've been consulting more with companies that are looking at market entry in the region or companies in Australia who are looking at finding the right market segmentation for themselves and business growth. So that's a brief background about me and my life.
Well, certainly very illustrious career, Sunil. And now, obviously, some of the work that you're doing here is much on more on the senior consulting level. But stepping back a little bit in time, you were saying before, you know, India didn't always have that powerhouse when it came to sort of, you know, the global service providers. That's been a fairly recent and rapid rise. So what do you think you attribute the success there to? You know, is it a cultural component? Is it a work ethic? Why do you think that's been such a large shift to a lot of the larger service providers that are based out of India now?
So India was very quick in adopting technology. Okay. And when I say technology, I'm talking about IT. So in 1982, when I did a computer course, there were not many people who were doing computer courses at the time. And it also was that in 1977, the populist government had come into India, and their their mantra was to throw everything which was foreign out of the country. So IBM got thrown out, and a lot of American and British IT companies and computer manufacturers were thrown out. And then there's this whole thing started that we should manufacture computers in India, right? So that was the revolution that kicked off at that time. I'm talking about 77, 78. And from there, the rise of the IT started to happen in India. And of course, initially it was all internal. And then the world started looking at, so if you look at history of outsourcing, even in Australia, the first outsourcing that was done by companies was done onshore, right? So let's say companies like American Express, and I still remember, you know, they were my clients. So they decided to go out and say, okay, who can we give out all this big development work to? Because this is not a part of our core competency or core business. And that's where companies like EDS and Aspect Computing and Praxa and CSC, they all started to come into existence, but that was all onshore. The next level of offshoring started to happen when they realized that there were companies in India, for example, who could do the same work at less than half the price, okay? And then the outsourcing started. And India took over that mantle pretty early on, and that's the reason it became a powerhouse. But over the years, of course, there are other countries like Vietnam and Philippines, and also in some ways, China, you know, coming up, trying to bubble in into some of the, or encroaching some of the Indian marketplace. But as you said rightly, a lot of large companies have set foot in Australia and basically made it their home.
What have you found when you did come to Australia? I know you talk about culture a lot in the past. What did you find there was a difference between India and Australia, obviously?
So the first cultural difference I saw was that because of the population size in India as compared to the population size in Australia, there was always a survival of the fittest, okay? So in India, people used to do graduations, double graduations, you know, they would go out and study, because the more you studied, the more degrees you had, the more chances of you finding a better job, right? Whereas when I came to Australia, I saw that a lot of my colleagues who were not even qualified to be in the IT space, and I'm talking about 20 years back, basically, right? And they were like, you know, maybe not even a graduate, basically. And they said, okay, let me try IT. And they get into the IT framework and they start selling, right? So they literally, for them, it was on the job training, on the job learning, right? Whereas in India, it was a totally different scenario altogether. However, things have changed in Australia too, you know, from being a country where anybody can walk in into an office and perhaps get a job, to a country where for the same job, for the same role, at least you have 10 people, 15 people applying for the same role, basically. So there's a competition that's happening now. Okay. So that was the first cultural change that I saw. The other was, of course, that, you know, Australia as a country, as a commercial environment, has been very conservative in their approach, right? Yes, they have come a long way now, basically, and I'm part and parcel of the grain, basically. And in fact, I've slowed down, whereas the Australians have actually sped up, basically, if that makes sense, right? So these are the two major things that I've seen that's changed, or that's been different between India and Australia.
That's pretty interesting. You're the best person positioned to answer that question. That's why I had to ask it, of course. But also, just from your business experience, obviously exiting businesses and so forth, what have you found to be the critical success factors or the key things that have made you successful when exiting those businesses?
One of the things that I have always worked on is not something that I want to sell. You know, if I want to sell a glass of water and you don't want to buy the glass of water, you're looking at Coca-Cola, right? I need to have the resilience to go out and say, you know, Mike wants, you know, a glass of Coca-Cola. I need to give that to him. And a lot of companies don't think that way. A lot of service providers don't think that way. And I think one of the things which I always talk about in my articles is most companies are inside out, right? They are not outside in. The moment they start to convert themselves into an outside in scenario, things will change, right? It's the customer. You know, 50 years back when my father used to run a business, he used to say, Sunil, customer is king. Okay, you got to give them what they want. And I don't see that there's anything that has changed in the 50 years. Basically, customer is still the king, right? They demand, that's what they look at. And today in the IT world, as against 25 years back, where the customer did not know anything about IT, they would just buy anything which a salesperson or a good salesperson, well-dressed, well-spoken, would go out and sell, right? Today, even before the salesperson walks in into their office, the customer has done their research on them. They know exactly what they want, right? And that's when they want to have the conversation saying, if you can give this to me, I'll have a conversation. If you can't, that's the door out there, basically. So that's changed.
Have you think, I mean, one of the big things as well, Sunil, obviously you've started a lot of, you know, business ventures and a lot of that's probably been bootstrapped as well. There's a lot more capital that's now invested in this market. And it seems to be much more higher pace. Do you think a lot of it is kind of, you know, here today, gone tomorrow compared to, you know, the business that you've built in the past?
It's a mix of yes and no's, I would say. Some companies are still being created, and yes, they are. They have got investments coming in based on, of course, how big they want to be. They still continue. I mean, but a lot of companies start because they want to just exit in 3 years' time or 5 years' time. Okay, bootstrapping is something which, you know, Michael knows. Some companies that you and I have worked with, basically, they've also bootstrapped themselves, but. I think the issue over here is about what is it that you are looking at creating in a business framework. You know, so a lot of times, if it is a B2C, most companies will look at, you know, 3 years and then probably selling it out to somebody else, a larger company. Okay, but if your product is good enough and scalable, for example, Atlassian, right? You know, it's an Australian company; they're doing very well, and everybody is following them around basically, and I don't see any reason why they will be selling in a rush.
So you think that passion's really a key point of it? You know, you need to really build something that you're passionate about and invested in. Otherwise, you know, if the heart and soul's not there, it's not going to really turn out the way you want it to.
You're right. Absolutely right. You know, and a lot of companies that start, I think they've already made the decision as a part of their business plan that I've got an exit strategy in 3 years' time or 5 years' time or whatever, basically.
And also with the segmentation approach you're taking for bringing companies to Australia and advising them and helping them at the moment, are you finding they do enough research on the market, or are you finding that they need a bit more help in particular areas? Is it marketing or the IT side, or what do you find they need the most help in?
I think a lot of conversation that I'm having at the moment is overseas companies have got the same mindset that other companies had about 20 years back, which is resource augmentation. Their belief is that even now in Australia, a lot of companies will go in for resource augmentation, right? And I think that coin has flipped, basically. It does happen. I'm not saying it does not happen, but is there an 85% need for resource augmentation? The answer is no. Most Australian companies are now saying that if I give you a project, you manage the project, basically. I will oversee the project as a project director or whatever. But I don't want the headache of managing your people, okay? And especially if those people are overseas, okay? In the current pandemic, of course, nobody can come into Australia anymore, right? You know, so, and I don't know when that situation is going to change. So most of that will happen overseas. And that's where the difference is, basically.
And you're finding that because of that outsourcing or augmentation approach is that it's lacking collaboration and ownership to get the real decent outcome to their IT project sometimes?
Yeah.
From that point of view?
Look, there are definitely cultural differences there, right? Okay, again, yeah. I go back to my cultural differences. Whilst Australians have started to understand the Indian mindset, and Indians have also started to understand the Australian mindset. But I'll give you a simple example. If you go to, and I'm not saying every company, but if you go to most Indian outsourcing companies, and if you say, I want this job to be done by 15th of December, I can guarantee you, you will get an answer which will be like this. If you think 15th December, we will try to make it 15th December. Okay, they will not commit to 15th December, right? But this is only because you, Mr. Customer, if you think it's going to be 15th December, we'll try, right? Now, in Australia, people don't accept that as a commitment, okay? If you come to me, Michael, and say, Sunil, I want this by the 15th of December, and I say, yep, I'll give it to you on the 15th of December, you stand confident that I will be giving it to you on the 15th of December, no later, right? And I think that's some of the things which need to be changed.
So more of a committal, I guess. So those are some of the interesting nuances, aren't they, Sunil, sort of between, you know, the markets where, you know, subtle language differences and the way things are phrased, yes, you know, can be interpreted in different ways, isn't it?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And again, you know, in India is still a very hierarchical organizational structure. You know, a lot of companies, a lot of modern Indian outsourcing companies are changing, I must admit. You know, there are professionally managed companies like TCS, for example, you know. There's a lot of changes that have happened in that company, but still a lot of companies are hierarchical. If the director says, irrespective of what the customer is saying, that don't worry about it, I'll handle the customer, you continue doing your work, the staff will keep doing the work because he's the boss. He's the one who's paying the salary, not the customer, right? And that's where it happens.
I mean, there's also been quite a lot of a shift as well. So if we take TCS again for an example, there's been a lot of acquisitions from the big GSIs now into other areas, hasn't there? So they're now Correct. Looking at innovation and changing their business model and evolving again.
Correct. Absolutely. And that's the big end of town companies who are doing the acquisitions, because they have been, like, for example, companies like HCL, right? I know recently they bought Lotus Notes, basically Domino's, from IBM. Okay. And they spend a whopping, I think, $50 million, something like that, basically. So they have the money. They've got the desire to go out and acquire companies, and which is what they're doing. But that also, as you said, that also gives them a good mix of new culture coming in and new processes, basically.
That kind of leads me to the next question. Obviously, adoption, technology adoption. Do we go to the global integrators, or should Australians or ANZ region be adopters of overseas technology and bring into the country and not innovate? I know that's been a big debate recently. That's a good one. It's a good one. But what's your thoughts on that? And you've been around long enough, and I'd love to hear, what do you reckon about that thought?
I am as much an Australian as you are, basically, right? You know, so I would like this country to grow, and I would like this country to innovate internally rather than actually depend upon other countries. And I think the current pandemic has taught us a lot, basically, as to why we should be doing things internally. Yes, there should be some dependency on overseas countries like India or Philippines or whatever. But again, one of the things that I've always talked about in the past is that we should always focus on where our core competencies are. Like for example, a bank, right? You know, banks, you know, 25 years back, banks were doing all kinds of development activities internally. You know, even the websites and everything else they were doing internally. Then they realized, this is not my core activity. Why am I investing so much of money on internal resources? So they started doing only the critical part of it, and they started focusing on their core competencies. That's what should be done. But innovation, I think, is something that must happen in Australia. You know, we have the brains and we have the will to go out and do it. It's just finding the right kind of attitude to go and do it. And I think that's happening. We are seeing good examples of innovation happening within Australia. And I don't see any reason why it should not continue.
Is there any particular areas that should improve? Is it more of a government conversation? Is it more about private investment? What do you think it could improve at the moment?
Well, policy decisions definitely will help, basically, right? You know, so whether we involve the governments into it or the councils into it, as long as there is a policy decision to go out and do it, and perhaps some kind of, I don't know, even an incentive from their side that, okay, if there's going to be innovation, you know, we'll do, like, for example, New South Wales government gives grants to companies who are innovating new products or services, you know. And I think that's something which is also motivating a lot of companies to go out and generate great ideas and convert them into products and services and apps and whatever else, basically. So something similar to that will do. But on the other end, of course, if there were private investors who were willing and who would not take as long time to go out and commit, that's the other thing, you know. I've seen conversations happen in the US, right, especially, and I'm not talking about in corporate business conference rooms. I'm talking about in Starbucks, okay? I can hear three different conversations happening in Starbucks when I was there in San Francisco, and somebody is pitching their business plan to somebody else, okay? And within half an hour, those people are saying, okay, I'm putting $5 million or I'm putting $500,000 on your business, and the conversation is over, right? Once again, I'm not saying that it is not happening in Australia. It is starting to happen now. But if I compare it to 10 years back or 15 years back, the conversations would drag on and on and on, basically. And that is, it's not a derogatory statement, but somehow the culture, which was very conservative, held people back from taking the risk of investing. Okay, that was not very bullish, but I'm seeing that a lot of people are coming up. I was actually reading about some companies who are very aggressive in the investment space, basically in mergers and acquisitions. So I think a combination of both would be actually a very good thing.
And do you think that, like you mentioned, I guess, is it a case of like being, in the past more conservative is sort of, that behavior is harder to snap out of. So, you know, it's a very different thing for me to say, okay, give me a pitch and then bang, away we go. Whereas, I mean, it's not just, you know, in the Indian markets, but also if we look at America, there's a lot of capital which is invested rather quickly as well, isn't there? So, and we've seen a lot of really good startups also start to move towards those markets for funding because, you know, a lot of them can't survive for that 3-6 month period for another funds injection and holding onto the current staff, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely. The only reason why Australia has remained conservative, it's a good and a bad thing, basically, is because, number one, it does not have any physical borders to any other country. Number two, Australia was always self-sustained for many years, you know, manufacturing, dairy, farming, everything was over here, basically. So they did not have the need or the desire to go out to any other country for any kind of assistance. Right? The moment they opened those borders out, you know, China, India, Philippines, everybody came in, rushed in basically and started to take things out. And then suddenly Australia found itself totally stripped bare and dependent upon a lot of other countries. So the conservative side of it, which was there before, was because there was no exposure, right? But today Australians are traveling a lot. You know, they're going overseas. They're also going overseas to pitch their business plans to people in America, okay? So that exposure is now bringing them into the framework. They're saying, okay, you know, we need to be risk. We need to stop being risk averse, right? You know, so the newer generation is definitely being more risk taking than they were in the previous times.
That's fantastic with that one. Look, we're seeing improvement, obviously, with that conversation. A lot of people have had on the previous episodes and guests have talked about that. We get to Series A, you've got to go overseas.
Correct. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Alaska's a good example, right? You know, and that's where it is. And we might just stay, and that's okay, as long as we have a strategy around it as a conscious nation. And the reason why I asked is you've got the high net worth who do like property. We all know that. That's very much a very common conversation in Australia. But also there's a government incentive, but also the VCs in the country too. There is a sizable amount, but it's very much very spread about what they invest in. It's not really strategic. Is that what you're seeing also? Is that a...
Yeah, I think the same pattern is there, basically. And a lot of Series A or seed investments are done by angel investors. Okay, it works both ways because angel investors put the money in, and it's not a big amount of money that goes in, basically. So 10 people get together, they put $25,000 each, basically, you know, $250,000 a raise for a business. Businesses like angel investors also, because angel investors are not overbearing on their business and the business plan and the functioning of the business, right? You know, the moment you go to a level where higher, basically at the VC level, then of course, you got to shell out a lot of your equity. You got to have them come in and direct you. And it could go straight or it could go pear-shaped, basically. And a lot of entrepreneurs are actually wary of bringing investors in the venture capital space in for the same reason, as I said, because they are afraid that somebody will take over their business.
Well, that's always the case, isn't it? That's a common conversation that I've had also the last couple of years, particularly.
Yeah.
And I know we've been advisors to other startups in the last couple of years working together, especially around technology. Where do you find there needs to be an improvement in the software delivery lifecycle? And what I mean by that, should we focus on testing, development, innovation, could be requirements or design or anything, architecture? Where do you think the world needs to invest more time in to improve software delivery?
I'll be honest with you, and living here 20 years plus, one of the biggest gaps that I've seen in the industry, especially in the SDLC, has been around testing. Okay, I can't stress that enough, because I've seen projects where the project manager has said, oh, let's take these test engineers out because I'm losing my budget and I need to get this job done quickly because I'm not going to get any more budget in, basically, right? Or let's take this testing procedure out, right? To the extent even that they have not involved test managers at the project initiation stage, which is very wrong, I would say, basically, right? You know, but that's what happens, right? I'm seeing a lot of testing companies coming up, and one of the things which I think which will really work for companies who are looking at new projects, you know, or even old projects basically they're currently working on, is testing as a service. Okay. I don't know, there's not many companies who are putting in testing as a service, right? You know, so you know, whether it is SIT or it is UAT or it is regression testing or anything in between, basically, you know. Previously, of course, you know, and even now, a lot of companies, first you got to write test cases, and then, of course, then you got to test them out, right? And of course, there are automated tools available. But if there was somebody who could go out and say, okay, you want regression testing, you know, you can use this for 15 days, go out and do it. It's going to cost you, I don't know, $150 or whatever. It's sitting on the cloud, boom, out, basically, right? There are some companies that I'm aware of who are starting to write test cases, but for specific applications like Oracle EBS or Oracle Fusion or whatever, and it sits on a platform. The test cases are there and it literally runs through there and tells you where the flags are, right? Or if it passes through, and of course you can actually put the program into production. But that's one area where testing has always been, in my view, the adopted child that nobody wanted, basically.
Yeah, you know, you're not half wrong there. I think that's talking from a lot of experience, obviously, with that mode, and obviously getting the speed of software delivery a lot faster. Yeah. Obviously, testing plays a big part in that, and the quality of that outcome, depending on that. What are you finding moving forward now? I noticed you're consulting and doing more work. Is data a big part of the future of your growth of your business where you're going at the moment? Is it consulting on that area or is there other areas you're seeing that you're
data is very much an integral part of every business. Okay. It actually always has been an integral part of every business. Okay. Starting with, you know, financial data, for example. How do you analyze whether your business is actually running into a profit or a loss, right? You know, or on the other hand, what are your customers thinking about? What kind of customers do you want? You know, so data is becoming very important. And of course, with newer tools that are coming out, you can really analyze the data in a very effective and efficient manner, basically. However, yeah, you're right. You know, I think that's going to be the next king of the IT space or of organizations.
In regards to, I guess, coming back to the services model as well. So like you said, one of the big areas from software testing, you know, it's not done as a service. It's usually done on a project by project basis. Do you see a bit of a growth and expansion in now the way consumers are kind of, I guess, buying and purchasing things? A lot of it is done now. It's all like one click, very easy. Do you think that, like, from an IT perspective, we're going to move more to that sort of fixed price? Here's the service. Here's your bundled options. Tick this and then away you go. Or do you think there's still a lot of room for some of the more customized elements that are being done around, you know, development and testing, or are people moving more towards an off-the-shelf model because it's simple and easier to procure?
I think the model that most customers will be gravitating towards would be the FSO, which is fixed scope offerings, right? And I know that, you know, same shoe does not fit all, basically. But the thing is like this, that I've seen this in my own experiences, that when we have gone to a customer and say, okay, give us your requirements, okay, then that opens up another can of worms, right? Because number one, the moment the customer starts to build a scope of work, then they're not only coming to you, they're going to three or five other service providers. That's the first thing. But when you go to a customer and say, I understand your pain points, what I can do is I can create a fixed scope offering for you, okay? And within that fixed scope, these are the inputs, these are the outputs, this is what I will be doing, this is what you will be doing, this is how long it will take you, this is how much it will cost you, right? Then the customer comes back and says, oh, by the way, in this particular thing, for example, you know, I don't want 2 terabytes of data, okay? I've got 5 terabytes of data. Then I can say, okay, this cost is going to vary it from, let's say, $10,000 to $12,500. That conversation is then becoming more acceptable to both the parties, basically.
And with that in mind, also, when you're actually getting IT costs down with that model, that SaaS model and so forth, is it more about getting the cost down if you are a startup or you are a medium-sized enterprise to get some more money over to your sales and marketing? So I know we've talked about this in the past is, you know, IT eclipses a lot of budgets. It can clean up, right? So really from your experience, I know you're very sales orientated and you really get that right. Is it more, do you advise to get your sales right and invest more money in that side to and also reduce your IT costs?
Eventually it will do so. One of the things that works for every organization, whether it is a B2C or a B2B, is marketing and sales have to work hand in glove with each other. And a lot of companies do not connect the two together. They will either have a very strong marketing environment and a weak sales environment, or they'll have a very strong sales environment and a very weak marketing environment. I go back to what I was saying before, which is whether we should be inside out strategy or outside outwards in strategy, right? And in the current world, it's all about outwards in, you know, which is what your customer is looking for. So marketing has to go out and attract your customers to you or the prospects to you. How do you do that, right? That's one side of looking at it. And when the marketing qualified leads come back to the salespeople, they can actually carry their sales conversation with the prospect saying, you know, you showed interest in our product or service, let's talk about it. And I think that conversation leads to something which is a warm conversation rather than a cold conversation. Okay. So if any organization invests into these two components and does it right or does it in a good way, I think on the other end, when you're investing a lot into IT, right, that might have an impact to lowering that cost. Because, you know, once the wheels start kicking in, okay, then of course the investments on the other side is going to reduce.
No, certainly the case. And also on that note, in that theme, is that if you are coming to Australia and you are investing and you're going to create a brand presence and so forth, is it more of the indirect way of doing it now through social media, meetups, industry events? Is that something that you recommend? Or do you go back to the old ways with advertising or, you know, magazine advertising and things like that, editorials?
It's a mix of both. It's definitely a mix of both. Again, horses for courses. You know, if I look at an Australian customer, right, one of the things that I've noticed about Australian customer is, and again, it's nothing wrong with that, is because they have been burned by so many other overseas companies who come and show gold, but actually give them crap, basically, right? You know, so they have become absolutely like, you know, okay, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to talk to you. So unless and until you are in their face at least 5 or 6 times, they will not even talk to you, right? Now for that, you need to at least A, have local presence, and B, have somebody who knows how to be patient with the prospect, okay? So it's a long sales cycle, right? You know, it's not some of those conversations that you can have in the US where you go in into a customer site and you say, you know what, hey, I'll give you 10% discount if you buy today, right? You know, and the guy says, 10% discount, make it 15. All right, done, it's a deal, you know? So yeah, the conversations have to be different basically. Yeah, I don't know if I addressed that question or not, but I got distracted there. Sidetracked.
Oh, not at all. No. That was good. No, it's just more about, it's not that, it's an opinion based thing. It's debatable also, because sometimes some companies should have more of a digital social media strategy versus doing hardly any print media or any old school legacy media and so forth. But obviously, this podcast, for example, is a way of engaging and communicating with people that you wouldn't normally otherwise. Yeah. But it's interesting to see your perspective.
Yeah, it's got to be a mix of both, because I think your branding has to be visible to people. Okay. So when I go in into a customer and the customer does not know anything about me, they're not going to talk to me, right? But when I'm making a lot of noise on LinkedIn and giving some post, putting out some posts and everything else, and I'm also talking to the prospect, they're seeing that activity. And I have noticed that Australians have adopted LinkedIn like second nature, basically, right? You know, so a lot of Australian companies and Australian professionals actually are glued to LinkedIn in more ways than anybody would be on Facebook, for example, in countries like Philippines, or even, where was that country? Oh yeah, a lot of professional people and companies in Fiji are on Facebook and not on LinkedIn. Okay, but that's how it is, you know, companies and countries basically, right? So a mix of both would definitely work for them.
No, well, definitely.
Yeah, well, we're kind of seeing those two platforms. I mean, the content on both is becoming very similar, isn't it? I mean, correct, there's a lot more on LinkedIn now that you never used to be able to write a post, but now, I mean, there's some questionable content, but I guess it's like any social media platform, right? You just got to kind of filter through what is relevant for yourself. But it's also maybe a case, Sunil, you know, like every time I've gone overseas, you know, and again, not to stereotype, but like, you know, the Indians have a very confident sales demeanor. And maybe it comes down to the fact, like you said before, that, you know, it's a much larger population, it's survival of the fittest. Whereas a lot of Australians I've dealt with are very reserved, you know, in that nature and aren't very self-promotional, so to speak. Whereas if you look at the American market, they're happy to self-promote. So maybe is it more of a cultural thing as well with these platforms on getting out there and promoting yourself or your brand?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're talking about America, one of the things that is taught heavily right from school days is how do you promote yourself all the time? It's marketing yourself. You are the product, right? And a lot of people in America do it very well. You know, I used to work with a very large American company about 3 years back, and the way they talked was self-promotional, right? Indian companies have taken a lot from the American companies, and primarily because one of the first countries that they started outsourcing to was the US, okay? US and UK were the first two countries where Indians went out to. Australia, nobody wanted to come over here, right? I think it was the World Cup that happened, the first World Cup. What year was it? I think it was...
What, the first one in 1977?
No, I'm talking about 1980s, which is when Australia opened the borders and the door and everything else. And I still remember Tom Kalma was the cultural secretary for Australia in India. And I attended one of those seminars.
Was it 83, the America's Cup?
Yeah,
and that, that was kind of the first thing that was like the global, the first big global win, I guess, that, that Australia had been
put. Correct, yeah. And that's when the conversations about, you know, bilateral trade between India and Australia started, and which is where companies, and of course, initially it was only the big companies that came to Australia. And then, of course, over the last few years, a lot of, I think there probably would be about 500 or 600 Indian companies over here.
It's funny you say that in line with that, because the reason why I asked the question earlier was when you first came to Australia was I found growing up in Australia in the 80s and 90s, it was really entrepreneurial. It was very much vibrant from that point of view. But then it became very conservative.
Yes.
And then now we've gone through this innovation revolution,
yes,
I would call it, globally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And using, and everyone's on social media, on LinkedIn, you know, trying to sell products and so forth and get that. But you've seen that. You've seen that conservative behavior, as you mentioned so far in today's comments.
You're right, yeah.
Very much so. But what do you find's the future? What does the future look like for you in line with working in Australia? Where do you see yourself going in the next 10 years?
Good question. One of the things that I like about Australia is it's one of the safest countries to live in. Okay. Having lived in India, where we had terrorism, having traveled US, where there was always racism. When I started living over here, that was one of the countries that I felt most comfortable with. Okay. So that's one thing which I want to say. And that's one of the reasons why I would like to continue living over here. Okay. What's going to change in the next 10 years in Australia, especially in the corporate world? I think there's a lot of professionalism that's going to happen in the corporate world in Australia. Okay. A lot of professionals are going to come in into organizations, and I think that's what's going to change the face of many organizations, right? You know, from whatever it is now to creating, how should I say, let me recoin it, to creating an environment where everybody is talking about growth, okay? And growth also in the positive sense. So that's where I see the changes happening in the next 10 years.
Well, that's something we're looking forward to, because we are looking for a bit of a change in Australia. Thanks. And as you know, it's due for a bit of a change, especially around technology and growth. Like, we like to see the more of the Atlassians, you know, type of companies.
Absolutely.
Right. We can do it. If we can, of course. I understand there's a risk factor, an appetite in Australia, but look, I hope the Australia, well, the government, the VCs, the private high net worths, the family offices do take more of an interest in growing homegrown needs, especially in agriculture, for example, but getting some out of there, especially renewable energy, of course. That's a big debate that's going to play out. I won't, that's another whole podcast for itself, of course. But, it's really good. But, well, Sunil, I'd like to say thank you for having on the program today. It's been insights have been outstanding. I can't say much more than that. But definitely have to have you on next year with our roundtables that Carl and I are organising, and definitely get you on with other people who've got their opinions around the roadmap for Australia.
Sure. Thanks for having me over, and I appreciate that, of course. And it's my pleasure to be around talking to both of you.
Thank you, Sunil. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on board. And like Michael said, thank you very much. And we definitely look forward to having you on in the next year as well.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Enjoy.
Cheers. Bye.